You're listening to This Week with Ann Carrick and Vincent Caprio. It's what you're talking about this week.
Week. Thanks for being with us tonight. And we're going to jump right in. We're going to start talking first about the economy, because of course it's been on everybody's mind with the deficit and lack of jobs, housing problems. They're all tied together. And to help us figure it all out, we have Stephen Waite in the studio with us. He is a self-proclaimed recovering economist. Mm-hmm. We'll ask him why he's recovering, as well as a professor of finance and an author of several books, and currently does work with ResearchToZero.com. So, Steve, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And Vincent, I really didn't let you say hello. Sorry about that.
Thank you for coming in, Steve. Steve and I work pretty closely together, and I'm a follower of his research. So go right ahead.
All right. So Steve, let's start with sort of a statement of the obvious. This is sort of arguably the worst economic and financial situation in recent history for our country, correct?
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm part of what people want to know is, like, how do we get to where we are?
Well,
we've got about 10 words or less.
Right. Well, I think whenever you have a collapse of the housing sector, it's such a big part of our wealth.
Individually, you mean?
Yeah, and if you take an average homeowner, I mean, their house is the most important asset that they have.
Sure. You know, by their car probably, but
yeah,
yes.
But you know, the problem this time is we had a collapse of the financial system, so the banking system shut down. That's always going to guarantee a depression. Like, it's basically like a patient whose heart stops beating and you don't have blood circulating in the system. So we had a collapse of the financial system that was brought on by a collapse of the housing sector. So you've got like a double whammy. It's very, very difficult to jumpstart an economy. You can have federal stimulus programs coming out your eyeballs, but you've got to get the private sector back up and running. You've got to get the housing situation stabilized, and you've got to get the banking sector back where people actually trust the financial sector. And if you think about,
you say trust, do you mean like from a standpoint that they'll invest money?
Yes,
trust?
Yes.
Because you're not talking about trust like trusting to put their money in the bank and save it. I think people still feel okay with that.
Well, during the financial crisis, my mother called me and she said, "Is Bank America going bankrupt? Should I pull my money out?" And I'm like, wait a second.
No.
You know, I mean, when you hear stuff like that, then, you know, when you hear an average person talk about, you know, should I pull my money out of Bank America? You're dealing with a pretty, you know, severe situation. So the difference between this economy today and a typical recession is you had a collapse of the financial sector, basically halting, a freezing up of the capital markets, a freezing up of bank lending, and that really hasn't started again.
No.
And a housing depression coming off of a huge bubble. So if you think about what the economy was like after the tech, they called it a bubble, but you know, when we had that incredible technology revolution,
like the dot-com.
Yeah, the
dot-com.
Yes. Right. The thing is different is that we didn't have a collapse of the banking sector, and we didn't have a collapse of the housing sector.
Well, and the housing sector probably affected more people than the dot-com, because not everybody was in it, whereas the vast majority of people either own a house or wanted to.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
Or tried to, but really couldn't afford to correct. Own a house, and so they got wrapped up in it. Yeah.
Right. And you know, when if you look at economic history, and you can look at around the world, when you see real estate collapses, it takes years to recover from that. Commercial real estate collapses we saw, for example, in Japan, that took many, many years to recover from that. But that was a huge, huge bubble. In this case, we've got both commercial and residential.
Right.
So if you look at the housing numbers, I mean, other than the temporary, you know, stimulus that we had from getting a rebate on a new home, you know,
like as a first-time buyer.
Yeah, yeah. You basically, I mean, I talked last week to some local construction people. There's nothing going on.
They're still not building
and
anything.
And the people that want to buy houses are having a very difficult time getting mortgages from the banks.
I know somebody, they wanted to move to a different house.
Yeah.
They both work. They both have good incomes.
Yeah.
He was saying, you cannot imagine. He was like, we're the qualified borrowers that they're looking for, and the hoops they had to jump through just to get their mortgage. I mean, they did get it and they bought the house, but he said, oh, so difficult, unbelievable.
So in the history of post-World War II recessions, this is not a cyclical recession. This is a systematic change.
It is, except, I mean, when you look at, for example, I was looking at the numbers before I came in. The real GDP growth has actually been above what we saw during the last two recessions. But if you look at where we came from,
because we got so far down before it started to grow.
Right. Now, you would expect, historically, you would expect a very strong rebound from a very low base. All right. But we haven't seen that. And you have to start asking questions. What is it going to take to get this economy, you know, humming at a 3 or 4% growth rate? And I can tell you one thing, higher taxes right now is not the answer to that.
No, probably not.
It is not the answer.
Yeah. When I talk to people, you know, I don't really feel that things have improved or changed that much, but that high anxiety from 2 years ago, where everybody was like with clenched hands, you know, they didn't know what to do and they couldn't even breathe.
Right.
Like they've gotten over that. So now it's sort of like a new normal. Like everybody's like, all right, so we need to spend less and be more careful. And they've sort of settled into this new pattern. So they feel a little more relaxed about it. But I don't know that things are really better. I mean, is that true or is that just a misperception?
Well,
it's a five-part question.
I mean, there's no job growth. I mean, during the Reagan administration, there are 22 million jobs created. I don't see in the next 5 years that there's going to be 22 million jobs created in the United States.
I don't think there's going to be 22 million jobs created, but there will. I mean, we're starting to see a pickup in employment situation. We had a really nice pop in productivity growth last year, which is a leading indicator of employment. But Vince, you go down to Washington a lot.
Right.
I mean, have you ever seen such an anti-business Congress in your lifetime? I certainly haven't seen it. I mean, how politicians can expect the economy to hum along when there's such an anti-business mentality today is beyond me. I mean, if you look, for example, over across the ocean to China, you've got
where it's booming.
You've got communists actually embracing markets and capitalism and the economy
in order to boost their economy.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because they tried the whole communist regime thing and it was like,
didn't really work.
No, we've got 1.3 billion people to feed. That ain't working.
We need to do something
for the listeners. What is the gross domestic product last quarter in China?
Well, I mean it's right. I think we're looking at about 9.5%.
9.5%.
Yeah, and you've got population, very, very modest population growth. So you're pulling.
And so what's ours again? Just to remind people, so you have 9.5 in China compared to us.
We did last quarter 1.7%.
So 9 times. I mean, I'm rounding off.
Can I ask another technical question about that? At one point, they said it was 2.7, and then they came in and readjusted it. What was that about?
The thing is, these numbers are very, very volatile. They're revised a lot. And in fact, the 1.7% GDP growth in this country last quarter kind of understates what's going on because we sucked in a lot of imports. And that's the model today, is that
that's what we do. Yeah.
We design things here in the United States. We have a heck of a service sector economy where we lead in services and high value-added services. But a lot of the manufacturing is done offshore, particularly in technology, because you have a skilled workforce, for example, in Taiwan, where they make all the computer chips. Asia has a great base for that type of manufacturing, right? Very precision, highly educated, high mathematics. Their school, they train their kids in mathematics and science. We've kind of lost that edge here in the United States. But I think that when we look at what's happening today, I think the key is to embrace growth and have policies coming out of Washington that encourage private sector growth and job growth. And we hear a lot of talk about that, but we're actually seeing policies that work against that. And what do businessmen do? I mean, Vince, we were just talking about this a couple of weeks ago. a lot of business guys are saying things are booming in Europe for them. They're booming in Asia, but here there's really nothing going on.
Right. I was at a meeting recently in Southport where they were talking about the same issue, but for the state of Connecticut versus the whole country.
Yeah.
And they were sort of saying the same thing, that businesses don't come to Connecticut because they just get caught up in so many fines and fees and red tape, and if
actually,
they need a permit for something,
right,
it takes so long. But you know, but their point was the same thing. If you want to attract business to the state, and the same thing is true for federal, if you want to attract business,
right,
and help them grow,
right,
then you need to let them and make it advantageous for them to go ahead and expand and grow and
we're,
do the
we're
things
actually
they need
49th
to do.
Or 50th in job growth in this state.
So we're at the bottom.
I
of
think
the
we're at the bottom. One of the,
right,
and I've seen this firsthand, and you can say it's anecdotal, but I see people that graduate from college with PhDs from big time schools, and they originally were from Fairfield County, and when they call the state to look for help or to go to an incubator, no one from our state even calls them back, whereas they're recruited to go to Washington State, New York State,
right,
Princeton, New Jersey. They actively recruit these PhDs to move their companies into incubators. That doesn't happen in Connecticut.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, you can take that on a global basis and say that that's exactly what's happening overseas, is that there are countries that say, hey, come and locate here, and we'll give you incentives, and we,
right,
have, you know, we have all the amenities and things that you need to do your business. And actually,
when people complain about having jobs, you know, sent outside the country, but if those other countries are luring in business with all sorts of perks and breaks, and you know,
right,
whether,
right,
there are,
right,
tax cuts, and you know, every country has their own tax system, but you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yes,
they're luring them in.
Yes.
And I know some of those companies are actually sending their employees from the U.S., especially like management, to those countries to run them. I mean, on the one hand, you can't blame them. Yes, it would be great to keep all those jobs here, but if they can't produce and make the things and still make a profit, then they'll be out of business altogether.
Another thing about the complexity of the situation, if a company wanted to open a billion-dollar manufacturing facility, we don't have the people to work in the manufacturing facility to build a lithium battery. That's the reason why they have to go to Korea and have to
that's
go to,
right,
China.
That's right.
We don't have the skilled workforce to do this.
Right. Well, that starts with the education system.
Right.
Yeah. And
I've heard that complaint too, even from,
right,
people who are mechanical engineers, and they said that if you look at the mechanical engineer pool, say, that you have all these people who are hovering around 50 and older, and then there's this gap. And they said the next person who came out of school as a mechanical engineer is, you know, late 20s, maybe 30. So there's this 20-year gap where nobody,
right,
was studying it. And so they look around and they're like, when we're gone, who's going to do this work? There's nobody here who knows how to do it.
I sit on the board of the Manufacturers, Fabricators Manufacturers Association. Now, this is going to really open your eyes. At present time, there's 100,000 job openings for welders. And the average age of a welder is 54, like you just mentioned.
So it's the same idea, yeah.
Right, and they say in 5 years from now, there's going to be 250,000 job openings for welders. So not only do we not have enough welders, we also don't have enough people to work in water treatment centers. I have clients, I have companies that are members of our association that have 10,000 job openings to work in water treatment centers.
And they don't, and they can't fill them.
No, because these are people that would need to go to a community college and have some engineering at a community college level.
So they don't have to be a full-fledged engineer,
no,
but just at least some good engineering classes that are related to those specific jobs.
Right.
I mean, we've moved away from cyclical issues and structural,
right,
issues. And, you know, there's nothing more important and more fundamental than education. That's the best, right, investment you could ever make. And, you know, I think I used to go into the public school systems and teach. And, you know, the conditions particularly in the inner cities, were appalling.
Right.
And, you know, these need to be addressed. It's a very local situation. Everybody has to address it, you know,
right, because each school needs to look at their population and their neighborhood and,
yeah,
see what's going to work for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, Vince, you raise an excellent point, is that businesses, if they can't find the skills that they need here, they'll have to go elsewhere. And you know, there are a lot of highly educated, low-cost, skilled workers overseas, and that's where they go.
Right. Let me ask you another question. It's a little unrelated, but illegal immigration and workers who are here illegally working, any effect one way or the other? I mean, I've heard people argue that, you know, they take jobs that other people could have, and then the flip side is, even if those jobs are available, most of the people who are residents and citizens of the U.S. won't, they wouldn't take those jobs anyway because they don't want to do them. I'm just curious, does it play a role at all, or is it just a separate issue?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the history of this country, immigration has been a very positive economic force. There's no question about it. There were a lot of people that came here because there was a lot of opportunity.
Right.
Okay? And if that's why people are coming here, because there's a lot of opportunity, then God bless them. Why they're illegal,
that's a different topic, right?
Yeah, I don't, but I think that, you know, are there, you know, jobs that are being fulfilled by people who are coming here from other countries? Absolutely. And is that a bad thing? No, it's a good thing. And to the extent that they're actually, you know, becoming economically viable, whereas before in their home country they couldn't. What kind of is unsettling to me is when people come from other countries and then vote for the policies here that they left behind in the other country. That's something I don't understand. I don't understand that. It doesn't make any sense to me. You're voting for policies that you left
that you
back
got,
home.
Right, you
here.
Escaped.
Right. So,
right.
So, you know, why would you do that? It doesn't make any sense to me.
I just want to shift gears. You had given a presentation to our board members in regard to the amount of cash on the balance sheets of the people.
Yes.
In Wall Street. Why don't you just articulate that a little bit?
Yeah,
more?
Well,
amount of cash on what?
Well, there's,
here we go.
There's I don't have the exact number. The Federal Reserve produces what's called the flow of funds accounts, and they produce a balance sheet for the entire economy. But from, and I pay particular close attention to the technology sector. There are tens of billions of dollars just among the established technology companies of cash just sitting
waiting to be spent
on balance sheets. And you say, well, what in the world is going on? Well, what's going on is that we're running 12% of GDP federal deficits today. I mean, just incredibly high,
right?
And so somehow the savings equation has to balance between the flows that we get from overseas. I mean, what is China really doing? China is actually financing our government deficit. I mean, we just don't have the wherewithal to do that in this country. So we have to suck in capital overseas. And the flip side of that is a current account deficit. All right, that's just an accounting thing. Vince is a recovered accountant, so he knows that. But we've got all this cash, billions of dollars sitting on the balance sheet, and you say, what are companies going to do? And we're starting to see, Vince, we're starting to see some acquisition activity, mergers and acquisition activity in the corporate sector, particularly in technology. IBM just announced a deal, and we've got a caller coming in.
We do have a call.
Okay.
So hold on one sec. Hold on one second. You know, go ahead, because
okay.
I think this caller wants us to call during a break. So
okay,
the question is
what happens to all this money sitting on the balance sheets? I mean, short-term interest rates are zero. Short-term interest rates are zero. Why are we sitting on all this cash, right? And what's going to happen to it? Why isn't Apple, you know, who's sitting on, I don't know, $30 billion, why aren't they paying a dividend to their shareholders? What are they going to do with the cash? They obviously can invest all of that. I mean, I guess they could.
Right.
But could they profitably invest all of it? I don't know. But it's a big issue. Go ahead.
All right. We'll take the call now. We have Steve from Bridgeport. Steve, welcome to This Week with Ann Kirk and Vincent Caprio. Did you have a question or comment?
Just a quick comment. You're into the program a half hour. I love it. It's nice to see a good, you know, some local host. I like the texture of the show and the angle in which you guys are coming at it about business. I am a business owner in the state. I have a contracting business, and it's a disaster out there. It's very bad. People who work for themselves, I think they really see what's not happening in our state. But I enjoy, you know, the chit chat, and like I said, I like the angle and the kind of points of interest you guys are bringing to the table. And as a business owner, I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Actually, later on after the election, I'm going to do a show on the struggles of a business owner. Because
yeah, I just I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, after the election, we're going to have to do a show on the struggles of the small business owner. And what's interesting is on CNBC, you always hear people saying small business, and actually it's a misnomer. The United States government defines a small business at 200 gross receipts of $200 million. So when
right.
people hear the word small business, they're not talking about the man that right. has the man or woman that has five
right.
people.
Like Steve's business.
Right. They're not, right. they're not talking about me. And you know what's right. so hurtful about this recession is, you know, it's one thing when a country gets attacked from an outside enemy, whatever. But I'm 53 years old. I've been through a few ups and downs, whatever. But you look at
79,
and they could make it better for us. Both sides. I'm not going to put in what side of the aisle I'm on, but
right.
they could really. They have the power. They could change things in a stroke of a pen. But it always seems like government never benefits the real small business people or the hardworking people. It seems that it always benefits itself. And you look in as you've gone through a couple of election cycles, and you just feel. I just feel lately just let down.
I agree with you. I actually was talking with Senator Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, and you might think, being that he's a liberal Democrat, he wouldn't want to listen to talking about tax policy. But I've advocated that any corporation that has $1 million in net income and below should not pay any federal taxes. Right now, if you're net income on your corporation as a small businessman is $1 million, you're paying 15%, which is $150,000. I don't believe that people at that corporations at the level, I think their tax should be zero. And actually, Senator Kerry agrees with me on that one, and Senator Wyden, and Senator Ensign, many Republicans. So that's what I'd like to see advocated.
And, you know, the kind of things I'd like to see, too, is like something where we turn to each other and we say, wow, did you see, like, my payroll taxes have changed? Did you see something where you turn to your neighbor and go, wow, look what the government, I mean, something
they
really
did to
substantial.
Help.
But they do these things in little percentage, and it's a nickel dime.
Right.
What are they going to learn? Let the people be free. You know, if people have money, they will, if the smart people, will save a percentage of it, and then they'll spend, you know, discretionary income. But
right.
our government, they have the power. They could say, you know what, we need to do this. Like what you're saying is a good idea. But it seems like you get into government, and it's just that long process of all of that heretofore and all of that nonsense. And it's just the rest of us, our lives are moving along, those of us that are in our late 40s and 50s. And you say to yourself, you know, when are we going to get a breather here? But Ann's point earlier was very well taken. When this thing happened, I always talk about when John McCain suspended his campaign. That's when, to me, that was like Black Thursday. And I was sitting in my office here, and it just felt that whole month of September 2 years ago. And Ann is right. This is like the new normal. And it's almost like when you're in a beacon and they turn the heat on low, you just get used to it. Where if the beacon is hot and you throw the frog in, he jumps out. You just kind of get used to it, and you say to yourself, what is going on? Why am I struggling? And it's all because of what you guys are all talking about today and bringing to the table.
Well, thanks, Steve, for calling. Quick question. Can you just tell us what business you're in? I'm curious.
I'm a painting contractor,
oh, okay.
local painting contractor. I've been in business for 23 years. I'm licensed with an A-plus rating with the Connecticut Better Business
Bureau. So you're a good painting company.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. All right, Steve.
Hang in there, Steve.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Bye, guys. Good work.
Thanks. You know, and we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back in just a few minutes and continue the conversation here on This Week with Ann Carrick and Vincent Capri.